want to remind you one more time that what we're talking about this weekend is coming out of my new book, Omega 2. Now, we don't have time to cover all the material in over 200 pages in any kind of detail, but at least we can touch some of the important topics and get us aware of some of the issues we have to be thinking about as Adventism faces an end-time world. So there's a little book, and Al Newhart has brought along some. If you would like to get a copy this evening when he's making tapes and so forth available. I very much wish I could just bring them and give them away where I speak. That would be my preference. Unfortunately, it's quite expensive to get books printed these days, and I'm in between $30,000 and $40,000 just getting the book published and in form that I can get out to people. And so I'm not able to give them away because we have to, a lot of cost to recover. But I thank the Lord for people like Al and for American Cassette Ministries, who makes a material available at the lowest possible cost. They really serve a badly felt need in this church, and I'm grateful for them. So the cost is kept just as low as possibly can, and we hope that it's something that, along with Al's many other tapes, can be a blessing to you. Well, this afternoon, let's begin kind of where we left off. Now, last night we talked about a golden opportunity for the church in which Adventism could easily have seen the coming of Jesus. Today, in today's church, at least out in California where I come from, you would be surprised how many Seventh-day Adventists say, "Oh, the coming of Jesus, don't worry about that. That'll happen whenever it's supposed to happen." Well, you know something? It was supposed to happen a long time ago. As early as 1882, Ellen White was saying the Lord could have come long before this had we not failed to do what He wants us to do in preparing the world. So, I don't think it's something that we can be complacent about. So, as we talked last night, we saw God's church poised at a moment of opportunity when the Lord was trying to come. Well, they didn't follow His plan, and as a result, we find ourselves 9 decades later in a much more dangerous and deteriorated world. This morning, then, we talked about God's plan for the church. His plan, just little pieces of it, as much as we had the time to do in the morning service, to give an illustration of how God lined things up so that if His people followed the plan, the work would get done rather quickly. Now, let's turn that coin over and look at the other side of it. For everything God has that's of any value in this world, of any importance to us, the devil also has something in the form of a counterfeit. So if God has a plan for this church, does it seem rather possible to you that the devil might have a plan for Adventism too? You know what his plan is? Stall us as long as we're silly enough to get stalled. Now, his plan involves something that any military officer would recognize as a brilliant piece of tactics. He hits us at least two places at once. He comes from the outside, but he also comes from someplace else. Now, let's open the Word, shall we? And I invite you to join me in Revelation 12:17. That's getting to be a familiar text. We have covered it a couple of times this weekend already. But let's just review it. Revelation 12:17. "And the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus." Now, let's just do a little old-fashioned Bible study. Let's go back to being Adventists again, shall we? That's how this church began. We weren't Adventists when we were born. We were Methodist and Presbyterian and Baptist and Christian Connection and lots of little denominations pulled together and began studying the Bible. And Adventism came out as a result of letting the Bible speak for itself. Time to do that, isn't it? One time I was studying with a Mormon couple, my wife and I, And they finally were baptized, came into the Adventist church. And he said, "You know, in Mormondom, we have the Bible and the Word of Wisdom and the Book of Mormon, but we also have these commentaries that tell us what we read." And you know what he called them? He called them, "Here's what you read, dummy books." Well, I'm not sure that commentaries aren't useful. I find them useful. I use them, but I don't use them to make conclusions about what the Bible means. I think it's time to let the Bible speak for itself. Now then, let's do that. Let's ask ourselves in Revelation 12:17 what we're talking about here. The first thing that appears is a dragon. Now, letting the Bible interpret itself, what does the dragon represent? Satan, doesn't it? A little later on in Revelation, doesn't it talk about that old dragon, the serpent, the devil, and Satan? John says it every way you can think of because he wants to be real clear we don't miss the point. So the dragon is Satan. So Satan is angry. He's wroth. He's enraged with the woman, which leads us to the next question. What does a woman represent? Oh, you folk are way ahead of me. You're already there. Church is represented by a woman. Now, it may be either a very good woman or a very bad woman, right? Very good church or a very bad church, but a woman represents a church. Well, now, if the devil's angry with this church, what kind of church are we talking about? He doesn't get mad at his own people, see? He's only angry at a good church. So the dragon, the devil, was angry with the good church and went to make war with what? Uh-oh. Remnant. Now, ladies, whoso, tell me what a remnant is. Okay. It's usable. She just said it real well here. A small leftover piece. When it's left over, what's happened to the rest of the bolt? It's been cut out, hasn't it? It's gone. What does that tell you about this church? Something has happened inside this church. They're not all there anymore. Some people have left. And who remain are a remnant. That tells me that the devil not only attacks Adventism, the law and the spirit of prophecy from outside, he attacks from within. By the way, I don't want to take a lot of time on this, but this is worth thinking just for 30 seconds about. You notice the two things he attacks, the law and the testimony of Jesus, which Revelation 19:10 says is what? The spirit of prophecy. Now, I'm not a pastor. I'm not trained as a pastor, so my approach to these things is perhaps a little different from those who are professionals at it. I'm just a layperson like you folk. Where I'm coming from is the practice of law and a career as an active military officer. When I look at Revelation 12:17 and I see the two things the devil attacks, the law and the spirit of prophecy, immediately I put on my military officer's hat and I say to myself, I am seeing objectives, I'm seeing targets here. And I see two kinds of military targets. I see a strategic target and I see a tactical target. Now let me explain why I'm going to burden you with that information, because it's important to remember. A strategic target, what is that? That's the reason why you're fighting the war. You're fighting, for example, to liberate Europe and empty places of obscenity like Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz and the death camps. That's the reason why you fight. That's the goal. You fight to liberate Kuwait. That's your strategic goal. Now, along the way toward getting that objective accomplished for which you're fighting, you're going to have tactical targets. What's a tactical target? That is a target that degrades the enemy's capacity to fight. Now, you folk remember Desert Storm? What was the first thing we did? We went in there with our highest technology equipment and we took out Saddam's radar sites and his communication facilities. What were we trying to do? We were trying to poke out his eyes, blind him so he can't see us coming. We degrade his warfighting capability. Okay? Now, you get the distinction between those two? Now let's move those ideas over into Revelation 12:17. The devil attacks two things. One is the law, one is the spirit of prophecy. When he attacks the law, what is he doing? He's attacking the strategic goal. Don't ever forget that the law is the issue over which the great controversy is being fought. Are we clear on that? Soon as the devil provokes rebellion in heaven, his claim is this law is not fair, it cannot be kept. So that if I came into your Adventist church near the end of time and I began telling you the law can't be kept, what would I be doing? I would be doing exactly what the devil is trying to do in the beginning of the war. That's the strategic goal. Now, along the way, he has a tactical goal. That's called the spirit of prophecy. What's he doing? He's trying to poke out our eyes so we can't see him coming. You follow me? That's the attack on the radar sites. So the devil attacks the church. There's only a remnant left. It tells me that he's been successful stirring up some kind of trouble from inside. Now, let's test my understanding of the word by going back to Luke. Luke 21:16. Luke 21:16. This is Jesus speaking, so he's a pretty good source, don't you think? If Jesus says it, we ought to be able to understand and accept it pretty easily. And Jesus says, "Ye shall be betrayed both by whom? Parents and brethren." Now, as you good folk came out the door today, I saw a lot of people to whom I said, "Brother and sister." When you're betrayed by brethren, what does that suggest? Something's happening from within. Isn't that right? So something goes wrong in Adventism. Now, what might it look like if the devil perfected a plan to get inside Adventism and really try to mess this church up? What might it look like? Well, fortunately, we have the lessons of history to fall back on, because the devil did it once with outstanding success. At the turn of the century, when everything was ready for Jesus to come, the devil stopped this church cold, and he did it from inside. Now, let's go back and learn the lessons of history. On June 28, 1905, while she was out in California, Ellen White issued what just may be the most startling testimony she ever sent this church. It is so unusual that I'm going to read it to you in just the first two or three sentences in exactly the format that she used, because I want you to get the feel for what she was saying. She entitled it "A Solemn Warning," and it reads as follows. San Jose, California, June 28, 1905. "I wish to sound a note of warning to our people, nigh and afar off." She's going directly to the church members. This doesn't go through the conference officials, through channels. It goes directly from her writing desk to the people of the church. And here is what she says. "There is deceptive working going on. I must warn all our churches to beware of spies in our conferences and churches." You ever heard talk like that? Astonishing talk. She doesn't stop there. After warning our people that there were spies inside our conferences and churches, she goes on and says, quote, "Powerful agencies have been stealthily working to sow the seeds of evil." End of quote. You want to look that up for yourself, get a hold of Special Testimonies, those little pamphlets she printed up during the Alpha Crisis. This would be Series B, number 7, beginning on page 30. Now, let's just recall her words, spies. That's an ugly word to use inside the church. Powerful agencies, that implies something very powerful is going on. And she says, beware. Now, in church circles, and I've served on a number of denominational committees, you don't hear that kind of language, do you? You know, the brethren, even when they're dealing with very tough issues, usually use a very bland type of language. You know, it's the kind of language that could easily put you to sleep after a good potluck dinner. Okay? Ellen White, as compared with the language that the brethren usually use, is using very brash terms. Her language is about as subtle as a midnight scream. Something horrible is happening here to Adventism in June of 1905. Something or somebody is trying to get a hold of this church. That's what's happening. And it's happening from within. Now, Ellen White put it this way. "There are men who teach the truth, but who are trying to conceal their defections." So they're out there and they seem to be going through the motions of teaching the truth and preaching the truth while they're doing something beneath the surface that they're trying to hide. Quite bluntly, she says, people would pretend to be something they were not. They would seem to be Adventists, but they're working on an agenda that you don't yet see. And again, she quoted in her manuscript 94, 1903, the following words, telling us how these people would work. "Creeping in unawares, they will use flattering words and make skillful misrepresentations with seductive tact. So whoever or whatever these people or forces were, they were sharp and they were smooth. They were good. Now, when something like that happens, it is not accidental. You can't just say this accidentally happened. This kind of thing is planned. It's designed by people to happen. Well, at this point, you know, it'd be awfully easy for us here in the latter end of the 20th century to say, wait a second. Now, Ellen White, most of what you say is good. Steps to Christ is beautiful. Desire of Ages I like. I can even handle some of the testimonies. But this stuff's a little heavy. How old are you at that time? Oh, you're 77 years old. Well, that explains it. You're getting a little old, and you're getting a little paranoid. You're starting to see boogeymen that aren't there. That would be something that would be very easy for us to say. But fortunately, we can test her warnings with history. Because 1 year after she gave this warning, guess what happened to the big Battle Creek Sanitarium? The pride and dream of Adventist health. Dr. Kellogg stood up to the church and he said, "You don't own this institution. No more you don't. It belongs to the public." And he had very skillfully arranged the legal framework to where he could make the claim that the church did not even own its own sanitarium. Now go back to her language where she says, "There is deceptive working going on to obtain property in an underhand way. There are spies in our conferences and churches." Is there a chance maybe that 77-year-old lady knew what she was talking about? At the same time, it began to be obvious that Dr. Kellogg was going much further than just trying to take Battle Creek Sanitarium. He was trying to seize control of the General Conference. Now, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, you know, is a democratic system, and thank the Lord it is. You know, what do you do in your local church to elect officers? You have nominations and you vote on them, don't you? And the majority controls. And the same thing happens with conference officials and your conference committee. That's the way we elect our union conference officials. And that is the way, by the way, we elect our general conference officials. And you folk, please, be in prayer this summer. This may be one of the most significantly critical general conferences has happened in the lifetime of anybody here in this room. I fear that once again, if the devil uses the kind of tactics he used at one other moment of opportunity, he may try to upset our church from within and turn good leaders out of office, maybe, and put into office those who would lead this church in a very strange direction. We need to be in prayer for our church. Because, folk, there is no place else to go. It's not something where we say, well, if things don't go well at the General Conference, I'll jump ship and find something else. Folks, there is nothing else out there. Where else in the world do you find an organized church with an organized world work, with a judgment hour message, the Sabbath, the law, the fall of Babylon, all of these messages we have to give at the end of time? So, we need to be in prayer for our church. Well, the Seventh-day Adventist Church thus was organized on a democratic system. Now, it works very well, but it does have, along with any other democratic organization in the world, a point of vulnerability. And what is that? That is the possibility that people who are politically very skilled and who have an agenda to push can try to use the political process to change the church. You ever been in a meeting, in or out of the church, doesn't matter, just any meeting, where you go and it's quite obvious the majority really doesn't know what has been planned? Somebody gets up and puts a motion, and immediately from someplace else in the room, somebody stands up to second it. And over here, somebody else stands up, says, "That's the most wonderful idea I ever heard." Pretty soon, from around the room, this ball gets rolling, you know, and this thing develops a momentum all its own. If a minority is prepared to do that, they can get the majority to vote something that they don't even understand. Well, that can happen in the church. Now, in Kellogg's era, for those who wish to change Adventism, the route seemed obvious. Use the political process of the church. Try to gain control. Now, how he moved was to try to turn good people out of office and then substitute them with people that were favorable to his new theology. Now, When the new person gets into office, he or she then has control over that part of the church. So at their leisure, they can begin now to introduce changes the majority would have never voted for if they really knew what was happening. So in, little by little, the church begins to develop the point of view of the new theologians in those areas of the church where they can seize political power. Now that's only the beginning. Once you get a few of these change agents in the church, you ever heard the term change agent? That's used today, isn't it? You get them in the church in strategic places, then they begin to network. They keep in touch with each other. They vote each other into key committee positions. Now, the Adventist church is just full of committees. We have hospital boards. We have conference association boards. We have college boards. We have all kinds of boards people sit on. If a few people really network, they can begin to put each other into control of more and more of the church. That's exactly what Kellogg was trying to do in 1905. Because in 1906, Ellen White wrote a letter to a minister by the name of G.C. Tenney. And she described a conspiracy where, quote, men were linked together to support one another. They were linked together. Now, she's not the only one to come up with this. In my research for the book Omega 2, I picked up Bob Olson's marvelous little booklet, 101 Questions on the Sanctuary and Ellen White. And if you haven't read that in a while, get a copy. It's well done. In that booklet, on page 46, Elder Olson says, a few key men were exercising undue control over the church through interlocking directorates. That's networking. See, a few people with their fingers in all the pies. Well, I think what I'm saying here should be obvious to you. You put a plan like this in operation, and it's only a matter of time, humanly speaking, until you gain political control of the organization. Because this is a recipe for a hostile takeover, whether it's a corporation, a government, or a church. So, put it together, and it's only a matter of time till the change agenda will dominate the church unless the majority wakes up while there's still a majority. Well, that's the nightmare scenario that could stop the progress of the church, because wherever this kind of behavior goes on, the church comes screeching to a halt. If it happens to a local congregation, what happens? You begin to develop all the symptoms of a church in trouble. The church isn't reaching out anymore. It's just expending all its energy fighting within. That church like that begins to stall. It doesn't go forward. And an institution where this kind of thing is going on will also begin to show telltale signs. It becomes more and more dysfunctional. It just isn't doing the job it's put there to do. It becomes less and less Adventist. Now, there's every indication that as early as 1903, something like that was happening in Battle Creek. At the Dime Tabernacle, for example, that huge church that once had a 3,400 membership, political factions began to fight. They struggled for control. Unkind rumors began to circulate throughout the church. Old friendships began to suffer. People that thought they knew each other discovered they didn't know each other anymore. So the tabernacle became less and less useful to the church. It began to be a church in trouble, while the Battle Creek Sanitarium drifted further and further from Adventist ideals. They began to have little subtle changes, like the recreation for patients on Sabbath became more and more secular. Ever notice how these creeping compromises nibble at the fringes? In such a subtle way that if you raise an objection to it at first, you seem almost like you're picking it at small stuff, see? And so it was at Battle Creek Sand. You know, in the medical field, you have an ideal place for the devil to make subtle inroads into things like Sabbath standards. For example, there is a lot of stuff in a hospital you have to do on Sabbath, don't you? You've got to feed patients, you've got to attend to their emergencies. When there is something medically necessary, you have to do it. But supposing now somebody gets the idea that the Sabbath is just too much of a bother, you can start to intrude now into Sabbath hours elective procedures, like elective x-rays that could just as well have been done Friday or could be done Sunday, elective laboratory work, or secular recreation on Sabbath. See, there's a big difference between doing an emergency ruptured appendix on the Sabbath and doing somebody's elective facelift. You get my point? So as the Battle Creek situation developed, you began to see signs that something was going wrong. Now, Elder A.G. Daniels was then president of the General Conference, and he later wrote a book called The Abiding Gift of Prophecy. And in his book, he describes how men of prominence surrounded Dr. Kellogg and openly, in his words, openly took their position in favor of Kellogg's book, his new theology, and his new teachings. These men of prominence were ministers, physicians, and educators. In other words, the cream of the crop, the very best we had. Well, their mood of a takeover of the church was illustrated one evening in October of 1903. Elder Daniels was on his way home in Tacoma Park from some year-end meetings, some annual or fall council meetings. And he was walking with another worker who was now, by this time, very much into Kellogg's new theology. They stopped outside of Elder Daniels' house there in Tacoma Park. They discussed these things for a few minutes. Finally, this worker got angry, and he said, "Daniels, if you don't get with the program and accept the new theology, one of these days you're going to find yourself turned out of office and somebody else will be leading this church." To his credit, Elder Daniels said, "I would rather be turned out of office doing what I know to be right than to walk with princes knowing that what I'm doing is wrong." So, the point I'm making is that when anybody can threaten the General Conference president that he's going to be thrown out of office, it's quite evident there is a political machine set up to do the job. Alpha Omega. By the way, what did Ellen White say? "Omega will come somewhere in the future, and I tremble for God's people." Maybe that kind of political threat is something we should think about. Now, let me explore two other little specific areas that I think you need to be thinking about. How would it be that a group of people who are still a minority in Adventism, the new theology didn't get acceptance in the majority, they were still a small group within Adventism, but how could it be that they would get as powerful as they did? Now, there are a number of things you need to think about there. We don't have time today to do them. They're in the book Omega 2. But let me share two techniques with you that you need to be thinking about. One of them is that the new theologians knew that the hope of their taking over the church lay in large measure with their attracting young people. They went after the youth of the church and the educational system. Now, for those who are committed to revolutionary change, you know, young people are always an attractive target. Well, why is that? Because the young mind is still open. You know, a lot of us who get older, we're kind of like cement. Our minds are all mixed up and set, you know. But the young mind is still open. They'll listen to new ideas. And so in a classroom, in a college classroom, for example, particularly where your grades are at stake, if you're a young person, you can be persuaded by your professor, particularly if the professor has a charismatic personality. So it's typical that people who want to change something will go after the young people. Remember communism? Remember something called the Young Communist League? I was in Moscow one day talking with an Adventist friend. We were right outside the subway station, directly across the street from the big Cosmos Hotel. And I didn't realize it then, but you don't stand and stand still and talk in a group on the street in Soviet territory. Back in those days, you didn't do that. And I could see my friend was nervous. He was continually looking around. And all of a sudden, a young girl came up of about 12 or 13. She had around her neck a red bandana of the Komsomolskaya Pravda League, the Young Communist League. She was a young Komsomolskaya Devochka. She just came right up and stood in the group. Just stood there, going to listen to us. My friend just turned to her and in beautiful, fluent Russian, ordered her to go, which she did. If there's anything Russians in those days knew how to do, it was take orders. She fled, but we also had to split because we knew very soon she would be coming back with somebody with probably an internal security uniform on. Okay? So the communists went after the young people. Anytime you want to force change down the throats of the majority, what you do is you go after the youth, and you hope that ultimately your opposition will literally die off. Well, that's exactly what Dr. Kellogg and his powerful friends did. The first sign of that came when his book, Living Temple, came off the press, And he sent it out to all the conferences, and he made special efforts to have the young people participate in taking the thing around and selling it. So he enlisted the young people in the sale of the book. Elder Daniels put it this way, "I saw seeds being sown among hundreds of young people that would produce heartbreaking results to hundreds of our brethren." Well, he also began using the young people in a political way. Battle Creek Sanitarium was becoming more and more the subject of criticism from church leadership and from Ellen White. So he got the students there in Battle Creek. He said, "Okay, what we want you to do this afternoon, kids, is write letters home. Write to anybody you can think of and tell them how wonderful things are here." Pretty good idea, because some mother back in Des Moines or Boston or Newark or Hackensack is going to be very hard to convince that things are wrong in Battle Creek when she's got on her kitchen table a letter from Junior saying, "Mom, I love it here." Pretty tough. So he's using the young people in a political way. But the thing that really got Ellen White concerned was that he reopened Battle Creek College. Now, in about the turn of the century, Battle Creek College had been shut down because already the apostasy in Battle Creek was reaching a point where the brethren wanted to get our young people away from that atmosphere. And so they moved the campus over to, guess where? Berrien Springs. You ever heard of that place? Well, that's how it got started. But technically, the charter for that college was still there, and Kellogg could reopen the campus anytime he wanted to. And in 1904, when he was struggling to seize control of the church, he reopened Battle Creek College, got the most attractive professors he could find, printed up colorful brochures, sent out recruiters across Adventism during the camp meeting season to convince the young people to come to Battle Creek College, and Ellen White finally had to warn the church. When Ellen White learned that there was going to be the risk of Adventist young people coming to this campus, here's what she said. I'm quoting, "How could we consent to have the flower of our youth called to Battle Creek to receive their education when God has given warning after warning they're not supposed to be there?" She just up and on her hind leg says, "Parents of Adventism, don't send your kids there, and if they're there already, bring them home." Now, she is telling Adventist parents, get your kids off of what at least claims to be an Adventist campus. If we're awake, and if we've just kind of registered on the fact that here's Ellen White telling Adventist parents, don't send your kids to this particular Adventist school, what would be the question we'd probably be asking ourselves at this point? What was wrong with it? That's right. You are awake. You're doing fine. Well, fortunately, she answers the question. Now, you can get the answers one of two places. You can find Special Testimony Series B, number 7, in the original little pamphlets Ellen White printed, or I've duplicated this in the book Omega 2. Let me quickly give you 4 reasons why she didn't want Adventist kids on an Adventist campus. Number 1, I'm quoting her, "Some who stand there as leaders and teachers do not understand the real groundwork of our faith." Well, what's she saying? You got people standing up in front of a classroom who don't even understand what it means to be an Adventist. And they're teaching our kids. Now, it would have been nice if it could have stopped there, because the next one is even worse. She says, "There are those who will become Satan's decoys. They will work to undermine the confidence of those in whose minds they can plant the seeds of doubt." Some of them just don't know what it means to be an Adventist. There's another group there. Not only do they not know what it means to be an Adventist, they're hostile to it. And any kid they can get into their head, they undermine that student's faith. But that isn't the end of it. Number 3, there are some faculty members on that campus who, quote, "hate the testimonies and refuse to follow the light given by God." They hate the spirit of prophecy. Now, let's go to reason number 4, why kids shouldn't go there. Not surprisingly, in that kind of an atmosphere, many graduates left the institution with hardly a clue as to what it meant to be an Adventist. Now, she put it in these terms. "Many of those who have been educated in Battle Creek need to learn the first principles of present truth." That's kind of funny because it's so absurd, but it isn't. It's sad because this thing was causing parents to lose their kids. About 1907, or thereabouts, 1906, I'm sorry, Ellen White began to get letters. Anguished letters began arriving from parents. They said, "Ellen White, we sent our children to what we thought was an Adventist campus." In her words, she says, "One father writes that of his two children who were sent to Battle Creek, one is now an infidel, the other has given up the truth." Letters such as this have been coming from different ones. Now, Ellen White isn't the only one I need to go to substantiate her concerns about Battle Creek. You ever heard of Dr. Neal? He's a very fine physician out in Loma Linda, African-American, okay? Dr. Neal is a personal friend of mine. He was a classmate of my wife's in medical school and training there. After a talk I gave years ago at Loma Linda at the Hill Church, Dick Neal came to me and he said, "You know, there's an interesting sideline to this story. After the Civil War, my family, my grandparents and so forth and great-grandparents were coming out of the South, out of slavery. They came north because they wanted to get away from the atmosphere of the South. Some of them went to Battle Creek. Those who went to Battle Creek before the Kellogg apostasy and then moved on are still, they and their families are still in the church. Those who were there during the Kellogg apostasy left Adventism and they're gone." So Ellen White's concern is a good one here. You see, it was happening just the way she warned. And she cried out in rhetorical despair, "Who is responsible for giving young men and women an education that has left a seducing influence on their minds? Parents, keep your children away from Battle Creek, and if your children are in Battle Creek, call them away without delay." Well, it sounds kind of like tough language. Before we get too judgmental about Ellen White, just consider something, folk. There is nothing in this world that even begins to touch the importance of a human being whom you've watched grow up. Okay? The big screen TV, the new car, the pension fund, all that stuff can go when you weigh it against the value of your child. Nothing in this world more valuable than your child. So that when parents send a young man or woman to an Adventist college, they are placing the highest trust in that college it is possible for human beings to place in anything on planet Earth. In your college years, people have a second chance at you. Now, the first time we're real plastic, we can really get our personalities molded, is in infancy. We can't do much about that. You know, all we can do is lay there and kind of wave our arms and legs and cry. But when we're college kids, we can do something about it. Studies show that there is a second time in life when the whole direction of personality in life can be dramatically changed. One of them is infancy. The second time is in your college years. It's no joke, people. It's really important to select where your kids go. Well, so Dr. Kellogg and group discovered that that was one way to try to seize control of Adventism. Go after the young people. Isn't it wonderful we never have to face that concern again? That's all in the past, isn't it? Or could we ever face it again? Now, point number two. I just got chance, you know, that the time is limited today, and I don't want to wear you out. You're being really very, very patient on a delightful Sabbath afternoon. But there's one other point I want to give to illustrate just how cunning the enemy can be when they try to get inside and change an organization. And that involves manipulation of the mind. In 1904, Ellen White wrote another testimony. She didn't sugarcoat it. This one was just as blunt as her one about education. She warned Adventists that in the Kellogg apostasy in 1904, powerful psychological mechanisms were being used. They were designed to bypass a person's conscious mind and influence them in ways they were not even consciously aware of. Now, I realize that sounds just a little wild. I understand that that sounds like it's way out there at the fringes. You know, as Walton finally lost it. His jet lag finally gotten to this guy. Now he's really starting to talk silly. Before you come to that conclusion, folk, remember, I am a lawyer. I don't base a public statement on anything other than evidence I'm satisfied I can prove in court. Now let me give you some facts. Volume 3 of Selected Messages, page 412. If you want to look it up for yourself, do so. Here is Ellen White's perception of the kind of psychological mechanism that was being used in the Kellogg era. Let us bear a plain, clear testimony right to the point that hypnotism is being used by those who have departed from the faith. End of quote. That isn't the end of the story. The worst part of it is that the technique of hypnotism that was being employed was a variation designed to affect people without their being consciously aware that it was being done. Are you following me? Now go to Second Selected Messages, 352. This was written in 1907, right in that period of turmoil. And she says, Satan often finds a powerful agency for evil in the power which one human mind is capable of exerting on another human mind. This influence is often so seductive that the person who is being molded by it is often unconscious of its power. God has bidden me speak warning against this evil, that his servants may not come under the deceptive power of whom? Satan. End of quote. Did you get that phrase, unconscious of its power? Now, if you've chosen to ignore Ellen White or not consider her to be an authoritative historical or spiritual source, this may not be persuasive to you. But before you choose to ignore Ellen White, I got a question for you. You know, back in 1863 when she came up with a health message that automatically reduces or eliminates dietary cholesterol, saturated fat, increases fiber, reduces our risk of heart disease, and automatically also reduces our risk of most cancer? You know where medical science was coming from? You know what they treated people? They still thought in those days that sickness was a result of too much vitality. So they would bleed you. That's what killed General Washington. They brought the leeches and the lancets out. He finally said, just leave me alone and let me die in peace. Little children would get sick. The doctor, in all sorts of solemn dignity, would say, Mother, your child's problem is it has too much vitality. He would bleed the little child. Or worse than bleeding the child, he would mix up something called antimonial wine. That was a mixture of a little bit of alcohol and some noxious substance that when you swallow it, pretty soon you see it again. Causes you to vomit. He would bleed the child and suck out their fluids and then cause them to vomit up all this supposed excess vitality. Anybody here who's in the medical field, you'll understand that with an infant small body mass, they can't afford that kind of fluid loss and electrolyte imbalance. Most of the time you killed them. That's why when you go out to these cemeteries, these 19th century cemeteries, you see so many of these little headstones with a lamb on top. There was an epidemic of infant deaths back in those days because doctors were so stupid. They thought the way to make a child well was to get rid of all his fluids and electrolytes. Kill him for sure. Now, in that era, the Holy Spirit says to Ellen White, you go out and you use what written material the Lord directs you to. In certain areas of history and so forth, there's truth out there that's a well-turned phrase. You can use that, but I'm going to show you the error and you leave the error behind. Now, in 1863, you tell me if the Holy Spirit wasn't working through her, how she took the truth and left the error behind. Because no doctors knew enough to do it. So Ellen White says, look, there is a form of hypnotism going on here that is so seductive it can operate against you. You don't even know it's happening. Well, of course, many decades later, in the progressive 1980s and 90s, psychologists would discover that it is, in fact, possible to manipulate people using techniques that are designed to operate without their conscious awareness. I mean, this has become a whole growth industry, hasn't it? Everybody from new age gurus to car salesmen to some health professionals are using something called neuro-linguistic programming. Is there a possibility that an early variation of that was going on back in the Kellogg era? Well, let me read some things to you. You make your own mind up. June 28, 1905, Ellen White wrote, and I quote, there are doctors and ministers who have been influenced by the hypnotism exercised by the father of lies. Now, notice who's getting affected by this? Doctors and ministers. I mean, these are well-educated people. They're normally strong-willed people. And yet they are the ones against whom this is operating. She even described the technique that would be employed by those who were using these psychological mechanisms. Let me read it to you. In the very midst of us will arise false teachers. Creeping in unawares, they will use flattering words and make skillful misrepresentations with seductive tact. People would be drawn into an error so powerful that, quote, when they once accept the bait, it seems impossible to break the spell that Satan casts over them. End of quote. Comes off Omega 2, page 73. Now, you notice what she says here? People would use flattering misrepresentations with seductive tact. That, my friends, is an almost perfect example of some of our pop psychology techniques in use today designed to operate against individuals who are not aware it's being done. Some of this stuff masquerades very innocently as just improved conversational skills. Let me give you an example. It's been fairly well established that there are three kinds of people. We perceive the world each in our own way, and there are three ways in which we perceive the world. Some people kind of perceive it in a visual way. You know, their dominant sense is sight. They like color. They're the artistic type. And so they will see things in a visual way. When they speak, they will frequently say, I see what you mean. See, they'll let little clues slip that they're a visual person. Other people are auditory. They hear things more. They're more musical. And thank the Lord for those in this room who are. I really enjoyed your talents. Frequently, that kind of a person will say, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. See, they will verbalize their preferences. Now, some people are the touchy-feely type. They like to feel things. They're kinesthetic. And so for that person, kind of person, you'll probably hear them saying, I feel that what you're saying is correct. Am I making sense? This is how people talk. They express themselves in accordance with their personality type. Well, along come some pseudo-hippie new-age types who get to thinking about this. And they say, wait a second. If a person has this orientation, maybe we could use that to advantage. If I could figure out if you are a visual type of person, then I'm going to make real sure when I talk to you that I always use visual expressions. When I'm talking to you, I'll make real sure I say, I see what you mean. Well, what am I doing? I'm building a subliminal bridge with your subconscious mind, showing that I'm mirroring your preferences. Flattery is very, very powerful. Many times people respond to flattery when you can't get them any other way. Now, the how-to-do-it manuals that show people how to use this kind of manipulative technique even give you little clues to determine how a person sees the world or hears or feels it. And you'll ask them a question, and depending on where their eyes go, that tells you whether they're auditory or visual or kinesthetic. Now, this kind of stuff is marketed just as harmless conversational skills. You're just a better conversationalist. But you know, I'm not terribly sure I'm real comfortable with somebody studying my eyes to try to figure out how to express things to me so that my subconscious mind will react before my conscious mind can. That bothers me. It especially bothers me if the guy who's using these techniques has a used car to sell me. Now, I would expect to find that kind of behavior going on a used car lot. I would not expect to find it in a church. See, the Lord never forces people. He never gets cute with people. He comes right at you, obviously, with the truth. He says, look, here is the way, walk ye in it, but make your own mind up, because I'm not given any pleasure in somebody being manipulated into following me. I want you to choose. The conscious mind. Jesus died on the cross because he had such high regard for our freedom of choice. So in Dr. Kellogg's era, she saw instances where Dr. Kellogg was using techniques which are recognizable today as some of these very same kind of techniques. And she saw in vision people who would be listening to Kellogg late at night, and he would flood the air with such a stream of words that he would confuse them. When they would disagree, he would misstate what they had said. That's a technique called fogging. It's used today in NLP. They would become disoriented, and then finally, she said, I saw the pleased, interested countenances of people buying into his theories. Once they took the bait, they were hooked. They didn't seem to be able to be talked to anymore. Something very strange was going on. Well, now, what relevance, pray tell, does that have to us? I mean, does that have any relevance whatever to people living at the end of time? Some 90-year-old thing, some white-haired doctor with a goatee used to do in the evening hours in Battle Creek. Do we need to be concerned about it? There's one reason why we need to be. Ellen White said it would all happen again. You can find it in Selected Messages, Volume 2, page 351. Let me read it to you. Through the channels of psychology and hypnotism, Satan, quote, works with that power which is to characterize his efforts near the close of probation, end of quote. From that, I think a couple of lessons we can draw. Number one, it will come back. Number two, when it does, we are nearing the close of probation. So keep your eyes open. Well, I think it's time to take a little break. I need it if you folk don't. Now, I would propose that our next topic move on to something that I think we could find useful. And that topic would be Omega. You know, back in that era of Dr. Kellogg's apostasy, certain things happened over and over again. They developed habit patterns. And in my new book, I've identified 14 characteristics that were very prominently shown in the Kellogg era and which I believe will be seen again in the Omega apostasy that will probably be the same event as the shaking of Adventism. If we can go back and look at history and learn the lessons from history, then we're forewarned, we're not as apt to be surprised.
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.